From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We've been to the ends of the Earth. We've been to the Moon. Now a trip to Mars is a possibility. On this edition of Fresh Air, New York Times science correspondent John Noble Wilford examines whether or not a manned voyage to Mars is worth the cost, the time, and the danger. Also, we talk with character actor William Forsythe. He's buried under makeup and prosthetics in the role of Flat Top in Dick Tracy. Arts reporter Stephen Salisbury has the latest on the NEA funding controversy. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers Howlin' Wolf. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House will neither confirm nor deny reports that U.S. troops are being sent to Saudi Arabia. There are reports that President Bush ordered troops and warplanes to Saudi Arabia to help protect that country against Iraq. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said he'd have no comment on any current military movements. Brian Naylor reports from the White House.
While neither confirming nor denying reports of troop movements, the White House painted an ominous picture of the situation in the Gulf. White House spokesman Fitzwater said the Iraqi troops on the Kuwaiti border with Saudi Arabia pose an imminent threat to Saudi Arabia. The administration says the Iraqi forces have taken up offensive positions, and President Bush told a cabinet meeting this morning they pose a threat not only to Saudi Arabia, but to the United States. Meanwhile, the White House says the 39 Americans being held by Iraq in a Baghdad hotel are there against their will. Fitzwater would not label the Americans hostages, saying we won't label them because we don't think it's helpful to gain their release. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
An Egyptian defense official has denied reports from Washington that Egyptian troops would join U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia. The denial came in response to statements from U.S. officials in Washington who said that Egypt and possibly other nations would provide troops to be part of a multinational force. The jury in the drug and perjury trial of Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry informed the trial judge that it reached a verdict today on one of 14 counts. But as NPR's Nina Totenberg reports, the jury declined to make the verdict public.
At the end of its fourth day of deliberations, the jury of 9 women and 3 men wrote the judge a note saying the jury had reached a verdict on one of the misdemeanor drug possession charges. But when the jurors were called into the courtroom and asked to report their verdict, they said no, they didn't want to. The confusion seemed to arise from Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson's original instructions to the jury, in which he said they could inform him of their verdicts on the 14-count indictment piecemeal. That may have led the jurors to believe they had to inform him, but the jurors did not want to make their verdict known at this time. The unknown verdict is on count 12 of the indictment, charging that Mayor Barry used cocaine with a longtime friend and Democratic Party activist. It is considered one of the government's strongest charges, and Barry's lawyer has virtually conceded conviction on this count. The jury apparently has not found this or any other charge easy to resolve. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
A Palestinian terrorist group announced today that it would release 2 Swiss Red Cross workers who've been held hostage in Lebanon. The group, calling itself the Organization of Palestinian Revolutionary Factions, announced the proposed release in an Arabic-language statement that was accompanied by an instant color photo of one of the hostages. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials lost just under 6 points today to close at 2,710.64. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mars is 35 million miles away, but it may soon be within our reach. President Bush has called for a manned landing on Mars within 30 years, and we've already landed unmanned spacecraft that sent back color photographs of the planet's surface. My guest, John Noble Wilford, is the author of the new book, Mars Beckons. It examines Mars' place in our space program and in our imaginations. Wilford is a science correspondent for the New York Times. He won a 1984 Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on space and science issues, and a 1987 Pulitzer as part of the Times team reporting on the Challenger disaster. He first wrote about Mars in 1965. Wilford told me what he thinks Mars has to offer us.
Well, in the long, 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 long term, perhaps it will be a place where people will live. But that's getting far ahead of the story. In our lifetimes and in the immediate future, two things. One, we want to know more scientifically about Mars. Why does this planet, which in some ways is very similar to Earth, why did it have such a different history than Earth? And there are a lot of questions about, was there life ever on Mars? We've pretty much ruled out that there's no life on Mars now, but there's a strong possibility that there once was life, and we may be able to find evidence of that. But the scientific objectives on Mars can be pretty much accomplished through robotics. And over the next 10 or 20 years, I hope that there'll be more unmanned exploration of Mars, including perhaps bringing back a sample of Martian soil. In the longer run, I think eventually people are going to want to go to Mars. It's because Mars has been a fascinating place to us, because Mars is accessible, because the technology is evolving that would make it possible, and because there's some political reasons why we might want to, particularly in this post-Cold War era.
Now, more than any other planet, Mars has been the subject of speculation. Even in science fiction, the creatures from another planet are more often than from Mars, I think, than any other planet. You've done a little bit of history on how we've viewed Mars and what kind of speculation people have had about Mars over the years. Why do you think Mars has been so much the focus of our imagination?
Well, it's an interesting story, and I suppose it begins way back with the Babylonians or even before. We could see Mars, and of all the objects in the sky, it seemed to be more different than anything else. It was very red, and when you think of something that's red and all these other stars and objects are very cool, pale, this connotes life. This connotes something vibrant. Also, as we developed telescopes, began looking at Mars, we found not that it's not only red, but that it has a number of similarities to Earth. It has bright white polar caps, and they seem to expand in the winter and contract in the summer. It also rotates in such a way that it's a day on Mars is roughly 24 hours, just as it is on Earth. The polar axis is tilted almost exactly the same way Earth is, which means you have four seasons on Mars just as you do on Earth. These similarities, the fact that you could see surface, and people began to see a lot of things on the surface that aren't there, such as the canals and oceans and things like that, but you could see a surface. Venus is a little bit closer than Mars, but that's completely shrouded in clouds. You can't see hard ground there.
Well, let's get back to Mars being red. Do we know now why Mars looks red?
Well, it not only looks red, it is red. It's mainly because it's rusty. The soil has a lot of iron oxide in it that's accumulated over time.
And it's the soil that makes the planet look red?
Yes, mm-hmm.
Now, you've said that the atmosphere around the planet is pink. Are we seeing that also?
Yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was one of the mild surprises when the Viking landers went to Mars in 1976. For the first time, we were on the surface of Mars taking pictures looking out of the horizon, and the sky wasn't blue. It was a sort of a salmon pink. And at first, even scientists were dismayed because they just assumed that the sky was going to be blue. And then they realized, well, why should all skies be blue? If the particulate matter from the soil is going to be red, then the reflective properties of those particles are going to cause a certain pinkishness in the sky.
John Noble Wilford is my guest, and he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning science correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new book, Mars Beckons. You said before that in some ways Mars is very similar to Earth, but it had a different history, and it ended up becoming a very different planet than our planet. What's the speculation about what those differences were in the history of Mars and Earth that account for Mars being probably a dead planet?
Well, I think one of the main differences between Mars and Earth is size and, of course, the distance from the sun. Mars is only about half as large as Earth, which means it has half the gravity of Earth, which is probably one of the factors caused Mars to lose most of its atmosphere over time. It just couldn't hold on to its atmosphere, and it lost the, with losing the atmosphere, it lost the running water. Now, the speculation is, once they've now seen this evidence that there's been flowing water on Mars, sometimes in floods, apparently, once they saw that, they began to speculate that perhaps in the first billion years, Mars, like Earth, is 4.5 billion years old. Perhaps in the first billion years on Mars, the atmosphere was much thicker, hence the planet was warmer than it is now, and you could have flowing water. And during that time, life could have evolved, because life evolved on Earth in the first billion years. It was a single-cell type life, and probably the same thing was happening on Mars. In the exploration of Mars in the future, both robotic and with humans, one of the objectives will undoubtedly be to look for evidence that there once was life on Mars, to look for fossils. There won't be fossils like dinosaur bones, but there will be some fossil evidence that they hope to find.
What would humans need to survive, even for a short amount of time, on Mars?
Well, first of all, they would need to take their own oxygen, because the atmosphere on Mars is very thin, about 1% of Earth's atmosphere, and it's almost totally carbon dioxide. So on early expeditions to Mars, you'll have to take your own oxygen with you, your own water. You would undoubtedly want to explore in the first missions, explore places where you could extract water from the soil. It's assumed that there is a permafrost underlying the surface of most of Mars. Of course, there are the polar caps, and in some of those there's water to be extracted. But if you can extract water, you can have that to drink, and you can also extract oxygen from the water.
What's the debate now about whether our explorations to Mars should be manned or unmanned?
That's always been a debate in our space program since the beginning, whether it is better to go the less risky robotic way or to use human beings. And I think from what I've learned from even the most ardent proponents of Mars exploration say you don't need to go to Mars with people, not now. What they would like to have is that be the ultimate goal, and that we continue and perhaps even accelerate robotic explorations of Mars as precursors to the ultimate manned mission to Mars. Also, what they would like to see is that while we are doing some more robotic exploration of Mars, we begin now or very soon to develop some of the technologies that would give us the capability to go to Mars with people when we so choose. Some of those capabilities that we need to be working on are larger rockets, boosters that would send up the components for the spacecraft that would be assembled then in Earth orbit, and from Earth orbit you would go out toward Mars. You would also want to have more experience dealing with life support systems for a long duration flight. Remember, going to the moon and back, that was an 8-day expedition. Going to Mars is going to be something else again. It's about 9 to 11 months out to Mars. You'd want to stay a few months there, another 9 to 11 months coming back. So you're talking about a 2 to 3 year operation. So you have to be very sure of your life support systems. You also need to do more studies on the physiological and psychological effects of long-duration flight on human beings.
What are some of the scenarios for colonization of Mars?
Well, that's going far into the future. A lot of people see Mars as the one place in the solar system where, if we needed to or wanted to, human beings could eke out a living. You'd have to change the planet to some extent. You'd have to establish glassed-in domes where you could then create your own atmosphere and recycled life systems. You would want to eventually set up power plants and things like that, so you could remain for a long period of time. Eventually, you could even change the whole planet. That's called terraforming, making Mars Earth-like. That would involve, oddly enough, creating polluting their atmosphere so that you could have a warmer climate. In other words, just the thing that we don't want to happen on Earth, which is global warming, we would want to happen on Mars in order to establish a livable condition.
And what would the point be of colonizing Mars? So to have industry on the planet, to mine it and bring the materials back to Earth?
I don't know what the point would be. I think that's something that's going to be so far in the future that I only deal with it as a possibility that has to be recognized as one of the ultimate objectives of going to Mars, is to prepare the way should we feel that we need to colonize the place. You can think of a number of reasons why we might want to colonize it. We might want to... there might be overcrowding on Earth. People want to get away from Earth for some reason. You might just, the pioneering spirit, let's set up life somewhere else. There's no reason why Homo sapiens should be confined to one planet in the world, in the universe.
I wonder what impact Earth's environmental problems are having on the space program and on the designing of goals for the space program. And I'm thinking that this could work either way. Since the Earth's environment is in such jeopardy, this could spur us on to try to colonize other planets. On the other hand, I think it can make you really think twice about creating the kind of problems on other planets that we've created here.
Well, it's strange that the environmental movement, in a way, began with the space program. Once you began to see images of Earth as a small, single, fragile entity, in the blackness of space, we began to appreciate, viscerally, what we already knew intellectually is that Earth was a fragile place and that we needed to husband our resources. In time, that has caused people to think, well, why should we be spending all this money to travel elsewhere in the solar system when we need to be taking care of our own home planet? And that's a good argument. We need to be taking better care of our own home planet. On the other hand, you can, as you said, it makes us think, well, perhaps we should be exercising the option someday to leave Earth. Now, I'm not saying that this is what should be behind the thinking for going to Mars in the next 20, 30, 50 years, but I think that's definitely a possibility someday.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more about Mars. And my guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning science correspondent John Noble Wilford. His new book is called Mars Beckons, The Mysteries, the Challenges, the Expectations of Our Next Great Adventure in Space. This is Fresh Air. John Noble Wilford is my guest, author of the new book, Mars Beckons. Space travel used to be called the race in space, and the race was between the United States and the Soviet Union. Now that the Cold War looks like it's over, do you expect to see more cooperation in space travel between the United States and the Soviet Union?
I would certainly hope so. Even before the end of the Cold War, as we're now proclaiming it, you were seeing more openness on the part of the Soviet Union. Even before Gorbachev came to power, Soviet scientists were beginning to open up and draw in Western European scientists into their program because they needed the expertise and the technology of Western Europe. So I think that there will be a lot more in the future. And this is one reason I was interested in writing this book at this time, because I think we're seeing opportunities that didn't exist before to change the direction of our space program. Sputnik, 1957, people who were alive and understanding things back at that time were shocked to discover that the Soviet Union was as advanced as it was. And in the context, this seemed to be a threat to the United States. The Apollo project was not a scientific project to find out more about the moon. It was a response to the perceived Soviet threat, part of this Cold War atmosphere. Now, I think if we're going to have missions to Mars, both robotic and eventually human, we should be open to the possibility of having them be international operations, because they're very expensive. And it would be better for nations to share that cost, because, after all, it is humans going to Mars, not Russians or Americans or Germans. I think we would want to use every opportunity to bring the Soviet Union into the community of nations, welcome them there. And this is one way to involve them in the international community.
I wonder what the state of the space program in the Soviet Union is in this period of glasnost and perestroika, and in a period of a very bad economy in the Soviet Union.
There's, for the first time, we are hearing opposition to spending on space in the Soviet Union. Sometimes the Soviet press is beginning to sound like the American press. Why are we spending this money on rockets when people don't have enough to eat? Because some of this may have been going on before, but it was behind closed doors, and priorities were set without the benefit of input from the public opinion. So far, there has been no perceptible decrease in support for the space program in the Soviet Union. The Soviet space program has always been a very methodical undertaking. It's just sort of one step at a time, no giant leaps. So I think that they're geared to a more long-term basis. I don't see any change so far, and as long as Mr. Gorbachev has control of things and doesn't feel pressured to cut back, I don't think there will be any cutbacks, because, after all, this is one of the areas where the Soviet Union has shown over the years. Its technology, while not as sophisticated as the Western world's, still has been up to the challenge of doing some tremendous things in space.
How would you size up American popular support for space travel?
I think there's a great deal of popular support for space travel. We saw it after the Challenger accident in 86. If there was a time when people might have said, oh, cash it in, that we don't want to be doing this, it's too risky, it's too expensive, let's take care of other problems. They didn't respond that way. They said, we want a space program, and we want people in space. Now, when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, though, and it becomes a choice of this over that, very often the space program gets the hindmost. So there's no great hue and cry that we want a space program in America. It's not the way it was in the 60s when the imminent peril seemed to be moving things. Now things are very peaceful relative to the old Cold War days, so we don't feel the need for a space program, but I think we inwardly do feel a need for it. We need to to feel that there are still frontiers to be challenged. We appreciate the technological benefits of the space program.
Some people have lost confidence in NASA because of the space shuttle disaster and more recently because of the problems with the Hubble Space Telescope. Have you lost confidence in NASA at all?
No, I haven't lost confidence in NASA. I think it's not a case of losing confidence in NASA, but being sorely disappointed. You remember that in the 60s and even the 70s, there was one thing in the United States that worked, that was achieving success after success, and that was NASA. NASA was almost synonymous with can-do and success. And here we find in the 80s that NASA, alas, is just like any other human institution. It's fallible. And so I think part of it is a disappointment. One more thing that is going wrong in this country. Now, I think another thing that is more real is that, like any other institution, NASA has probably suffered from some hardening of the arteries. It's an older institution. A lot of the fired-up people who ran it and worked there in the 60s have either left or retired or are about to retire. So it's probably not as vibrant a place. Also, in the 70s, there were so many cutbacks in the NASA program that they weren't attracting the bright young people in engineering and science. So I think all of these things have caught up with us. Now, most of the problems that we're seeing right now that have cropped up with the Hubble telescope, the shuttles, and other things are really a consequence of management decisions or flaws, if you will, back in the early 80s or in the 1970s. So it's not quite fair to jump to the conclusion that the present management of NASA is incompetent.
Would you ever want to travel in space yourself? Is this one of your fantasies?
Well, I applied for the Journalist in Space program for the shuttle and was on the short list when the accident occurred. So I was eager to go in space in the shuttle, and if the opportunity came, I would go right now. But I don't think the opportunity is going to come anytime soon. I doubt if I would want to go to Mars. That, you know, 3 years cooped up in a spaceship is a bit much.
Yeah, I find the average airplane flight difficult enough.
Right.
I want to thank you for talking with us about Mars. And my guest has been John Noble Wilford, the Pulitzer Prize-winning science correspondent for The New York Times, and his new book is called Mars Beckons. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a talk with film critic Andrew Saras. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. William Forsythe plays the gangster Flat Top in Dick Tracy. Coming up, Forsythe tells us about acting in movies directed by Warren Beatty, Sergio Leone, and Paul Schrader. Also, Stephen Salisbury reports on a meeting of the National Endowment for the Arts Advisory Council, the latest development in the controversy over government funding of the arts. And rock historian Ed Ward has a profile of bluesman Howlin' Wolf. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There are reports this evening quoting unidentified Bush administration officials that the U.S. is getting ready to deploy U.S. troops and aircraft to Saudi Arabia. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
The U.S. personnel, reportedly 4,000 strong, would be part of a multinational force. Their mission is to act as a tripwire in the event that Iraqi troops based in Kuwait attack oil-rich Saudi Arabia. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that Iraq posed an imminent threat to Saudi Arabia. Fitzwater refused to confirm or deny the reports that U.S. troops would be deployed. The report leaked after Secretary of Defense Richard Cheney concluded 2 days of meetings with Saudi officials, successfully convincing them to host a multinational force. The administration is reportedly also discussing organizing an international blockade of Iraq as long as it occupies Kuwait. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The Soviet Union says that it prefers political pressure to an international military buildup to force Iraqi troops out of Kuwait. Moscow, though, is sending 2 warships to protect Soviet commercial interest in the Persian Gulf. The State Department says that most of the Americans picked up by Iraqi troops in Kuwait are now in a Baghdad hotel, but are not allowed to leave the building. U.S. officials have met with some of those Americans, who were among 300 foreigners picked up yesterday and taken by bus to Baghdad. In a nationwide speech on Iraqi television, Iraqi President Hussein has sought to justify last week's invasion of Kuwait. He called the operation a legitimate outcome of Iraq's victory over Iran in the Gulf War, which he said meant the end of a colonial division separating a rich minority from the less fortunate majority. Tim Llewellyn of the BBC has more.
The tension in the region is as high as it has been since the Iraqis invaded Kuwait. President Saddam Hussein of Iraq has been making a stirring address on Iraqi television and radio tonight, the anniversary of the end of the Gulf War, in which he makes clear his visionary, special view of Iraq's unique role in the region. He is promising to resist to the full all outside attempts to force him out of Kuwait. At the same time, as the pressure builds up, the West is trying desperately to get its citizens out of the area, particularly eastern Saudi Arabia, the oil-rich provinces, where it is thought Iraq could attack. Even in the United Arab Emirates, there have been evacuation drills for local people, and the whole Gulf seems to be preparing for the worst.
Tim Llewellyn, the BBC. An army-supported caretaker government has assumed power in Pakistan and has ordered former Prime Minister Bhutto and other top officials not to leave the country. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 6 points to close at 2,710.64 on volume of some 232 million shares. Trading was very heavy. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In a little while, we'll meet the actor who plays Flat Top in the movie Dick Tracy. But first, there aren't many blues musicians who made the transition from backcountry blues to the electric urban blues of the 1950s. Rock historian Ed Ward says he can think of only 2, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. Muddy Waters may be the better-known musician, but Ed says Howlin' Wolf was just as good.
He was born somewhere in Mississippi in 1910 and named Chester Arthur Burnett after the 21st president. His family were tenant farmers, and eventually young Chester found himself on the same farm as Charlie Patton, one of the most legendary of all Delta blues men. Chester had just gotten a guitar, and Charlie taught him a little bit. He learned harmonica from Rice Miller, who later married Chester's half-sister, and at one point he and Rice traveled with Robert Johnson, the greatest Delta musician of all. But it wasn't until he was 38 years old and had most of a lifetime of farming and weekend playing behind him that Chester Burnett moved to West Memphis, Arkansas, and became a professional musician.
Yeah, somebody knocking on my door.
He'd taken the name Howlin' Wolf from a little-known blues man named J.T. Smith and found himself a band of men half his age. His reputation was such that when Sam Phillips opened the Memphis Recording Service, Wolf and his band became one of the first acts he recorded. He sent the master tape of Moanin' at Midnight to Chess Records, a brand-new blues label in Chicago. It was an immediate smash, although sales were hurt by the fact that Wolf had recorded it again for another label, which released it as Morning at Midnight. But Chess had another classic in the can, which became one of the top records of 1952. Were simply country blues records, electrified and overlaid with some very basic urban blues sounds, like the piano on How Many More Years, played by Ike Turner. They struck a responsive chord in the masses of rural black people who'd moved north to Chicago, and the Chess Brothers let Wolf know that if he'd make the move himself, he'd soon be a huge star. He couldn't convince his band to make the move, but he did it himself, leaving town in a brand new Cadillac with $3,900 in cash in his pocket. The Chess Brothers were right. Wolf became a big star, almost as big as his rival, Muddy Waters. He recorded with Muddy's band at first, but soon he brought up Willie Jackson and Hubert Sumlin, two guitarists he'd worked with in the South, and they became part of his sound.
If you're a long way from home, can't sleep at night, grab your telephone, something just ain't right, that's evil. Evil is going on wrong. I am warning you, brother. You better watch your happy home.
Wolf played harmonica, although not as well as his teacher, who was now calling himself Sonny Boy Williamson and also living in Chicago, and sang in a voice that was such a distillation of darkness that it was instantly recognizable. He wrote most of his material, and he and Hubert Sumlin, the guitarist he called his son, did the arrangements, which were as off the wall as Wolf himself. While some people might ask what Smokestack Lightning is, the musicians on that session were probably wondering when Wolf would erupt with the next verse. As late as this record, 1956, he still had that country blues feel. But the audience was becoming more sophisticated, what with rock and roll on one side and Muddy Waters' more complex approach to blues on the other. Wolf was told to modernize or get lost, and Hubert Sumlin came to the rescue with a distorted guitar sound that was the perfect compromise. Throughout the 60s, Wolf continued to sell enough records to keep Chess happy, although they did once force him to record a shameful psychedelic album that was decried by his old and his new fans. He toured and did some of the blues festivals that young white fans were organizing, but his time had passed as a popular figure. Remote, often bitter and peculiar acting, Wolfe was revered and feared by people who heard him. He died in 1976, one of the last blues singers with roots in the Mississippi Delta tradition.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. If you had a hard time recognizing Dustin Hoffman and Al Pacino in the film Dick Tracy, you certainly wouldn't recognize my guest William Forsythe. He played Flat Top, the gangster with the large face, flat hairdo, and sinister look in his eyes. Flat Top is one of several criminals Forsythe has played, and once upon a time in America, he was one of Robert De Niro's bootlegging partners. He was Bert the Booster, a convict turned actor in Weeds, an escaped convict in Raising Arizona, and Patty Hearst's kidnapper William Harris in Patty Hearst. Dick Tracy is the biggest picture he's worked on, but it's the one where you never see his real face. Forsythe told me he wasn't bothered by this anonymity.
In fact, I went to see the movie at a movie theater somewhere down. It was in Biloxi, Mississippi. It was a really tiny little theater. And of course, nobody recognized me. I sat there through the whole film. But in a lot of ways, it was interesting because I got to sit there and listen to the kids' reaction to the film and just kind of be right there. I mean, if I went up to one of them and said, hey, I'm Flat Top, they'd probably think I was a weirdo or something. But when they were leaving the theater, all the kids were like arguing, and they were like kind of like, you know, a lot of them were just talking about, hey, I'm Flat Top, hey, I'm, you know, this, and they were talking like that, and it was kind of fun.
So is there anything that makes you feel freed up about having a different face on?
Yeah. You look in the mirror and see a different person. Well, you know, there's a lot of freedom in characters that you portray. I find that in all the characters. I didn't find any more freedom because I had this rubber face on. You know, if anything, I tried to forget that it was this rubber and tried to really just make it my face. There's a lot of freedom that you get from playing a character. I mean, there are a lot of things that I wouldn't do that my characters would certainly do.
You know, I find with every actor that I really like a lot, there's a movie or a scene that makes me think, wow, this person is someone I really want to pay attention to. And with you, I think that scene was in Patty Hearst. The film directed by Paul Schrader, it was made, I think, in 1988. You were a member of the SLA. And the movie is a lot, really, about the rhetoric of radical politics and about the romantic fantasies of being guerrilla warriors engaged in the struggle and everything. And your fantasy in the movie is that you want to be black.
Yeah, William Harris. Yeah.
And I think you know the scene that I'm describing particularly. Would you describe the scene?
Well, yeah, Well, from all the reading that I'd done and everything, all the research on Bill Harris, I mean, there was, and Patty Hearst herself had mentioned that he had a great, he'd spend a lot of time in the mirror and just looking into the mirror and talking and, you know, and for whatever his reasonings were. And so I really nailed into this scene. I really wanted to do it. And I had asked Paul Schrader, you know, I said, can you just let me, you know, I'd asked him something that it was hard for him to give. I said, can you just roll the camera and just let me talk, you know? And I got into the makeup and I spent a lot of time in the mirror and just prepared myself for this moment. And then I related it to an incident or so that had happened to me as a child, where I grew up in Brooklyn, and strangely enough, I portrayed somebody at that moment. The actual dialogue I used and everything was actually someone when I was like about 12 years old. This guy had mugged me. he was an older guy. I guess he was about 16 or so. And every day he would be looking for me. And I used what this guy said, or the essence of it. I began with that, and I just let myself go into the mirror and just try to find, you know, this guy who was portraying himself as this black man. And and what happened from it, I guess they rolled the camera. I mean, the cameras were rolling for about 5 minutes or so, and then we ended up with what we ended up with in the film that they used.
Yo, man, where is that, man? Yo. Yo. Yo, white boy, I'm talking to you, man. I said, where's that, man? What you got for the head? Let me catch you square, baby. You got some change for me, man?
It's a great scene, and you for the scene, you put on black makeup, you have like an afro on, a leather jacket. Was the idea of having this fantasy of being black in the script, or did you bring that to the movie as well?
It was played in the script, but it was very downplayed. I really wanted to do it, and I it was a scene that I knew that I could do, that I could bring something to it, just, you know, something maybe from my personal experience that would relate exactly at that moment. So I worked as much as I could. I worked on Ball and, you know, and tried to convince him to let me, you know, go with it, and he did, and it was a lot of fun to be able to do that.
Let me ask you about some of the directors that you've worked with, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about their directing style and what it was like to work with them. Why don't we start with Paul Schrader, since he directed Patty Hearst, the film we were just talking about.
I was a big fan of Paul's, you know, because, I mean, he had written, you know, quite a few scripts that I loved.
Taxi Driver.
Yeah, specifically. Yeah, I love Taxi Driver. You know, I just, like, when I was, you know, that age. And as a director, I had admired him. I had looked forward to stepping in and working with Paul. Paul was a very good director, but it was very difficult. Like for me, you know, we had this thing where I was basically getting into the character of William Harris, who was somebody who, you know, is always questioning the authority, questioning, and, you know, somebody who wants to be the leader. And the funny thing happened was I kind of had that relationship with Paul. I was always like, you know, right up, you know, and I think it worked for me, and I would use it in the part and everything like that, and it just happened that way. It wasn't something I really planned. It was just a certain style that, you know, I would get into what I was doing and the way he would speak to me, and I would just always just, you know, hey Paul, if you're out there, you know, sorry brother, but that's kind of what I ended up doing. Like every time that he would say something, I'd be like, what, why, you know, I'd be suddenly questioning and I realized about halfway through the film that is exactly, you know, what this guy is doing. You know, he's, you know, he wants to be the guy. He wants to be the leader. You know, he wants to be the one.
You work with the Italian director Sergio Leone in Once Upon a Time in America. What was he like to work with?
Well, as my experiences go, Sergio was to date was my favorite director to work with. From the moment I met him, it was just something about him. There was a very spiritual thing. First of all, the way I had met him, I had done a screen test. I'd went in and I really didn't have, I didn't know at the time, strangely enough, until actually I had done the screen test, that it was a Robert De Niro film and that Sergio Leone was going to direct. I went in, I did my screen test, and I walked out, and the next thing I know, by the time I got home, I had a phone call, and he called me back in. And the thing is, when I had done my screen test, I had done this choice, which was, I did this thing with my eye. My grandfather, he was quite a character. He lived in that era. And anyway, he had this thing when he would get angry, his eye would just, you know, I could just see his eye moving a little bit. You know, he just had this thing. Well, anyway, Sergio called me up and he was like, oh, this thing you do with your eye. And it was just fantastic. He hooked right into that. And that became, and he had pretty much, as he put it, the part is 90% yours. I see other people, you know. so it took 4 months for the other 10% to come around. But you know, but he had hooked right into that. And I said, wow. I said, you know, because I could have easily just left that choice out, but something in me said, do it. And that's what I always loved about him. When we worked together, his eye, he had an eye. Because in the movie, of course, I cocked the eye because the character's cock eye, and I had the eye shut part. One time, just kidding around, I had gotten on the, we were in this huge, huge, the speakeasy scenes, you know, those big, huge room, hundreds and hundreds of people. And so just for a joke, I closed the wrong eye, you know, from way across the room. Sergio was way across the room. And I also had, in the scene, I had three flowers in my hand. And instead, I had five. So the next thing I know, from way across the room, Sergio looks at me, a good 100 feet away, 200 feet, and he looks at me, and he does this with his eye. He switches his eye for me, like, in other words, to tell me, I see that you've got the wrong eye shut, and then he puts up his fingers three for three flowers, you know. Yeah, and here we were in a scene with hundreds and hundreds of people, and you know, there was nothing that could slip by him, you know. And I was just doing it, you know, to kid him, but he was just that precise, and that's, you know, that's why it was such, one of the reasons it was a great pleasure.
What about working with Warren Beatty on Dick Tracy?
Yeah, Warren. Well, Warren and Sergio shared a lot in common. One of the things they shared in common was they both liked to do a lot of takes. Warren, when I worked with Warren, I mean, it was not uncommon that we would do 20 or 30 takes in a scene, you know, for each setup and things like that, which I, you know, I guess I had already worked with Sergio because Sergio was the same way. I remember one time we did like 94 takes or something.
Wow.
On one scene. And I guess a lot of actors and a lot of people when working on a film, doing a lot of takes, they don't really like or anything like that. But I don't mind. I like it. I think it's sort of, you get to do a rehearsal over and over and over. And a lot of times you can end up with a very interesting thing. Warren liked that. As you know, other ways as a director, he's, he knows what he wants, very much so. or at least he leads us to believe that. And he knows exactly what he wants, in my opinion. And he turns around and he just will do something over and over until he gets what he's looking for.
You are the actor William Forsythe. Then there's the Scottish director Bill Forsythe. Do you ever get confused for each other just
not
on
now.
Paper?
A couple of years ago, we used to, I guess, a little bit, yeah. I remember one time a magazine, I won't say which one, they wanted to know, quote-unquote, my opinion on the Oscars. So there I was on the phone, you know, and I'm giving my opinion a mile a minute to them, you know. It was finally, you know, the guy turns around, you know, and I guess he realizes that he didn't hit me, brogue, you know, or something. And he just said, are you Bill Forsythe? I said, yes. And I said, are you Bill Forsythe, the director? I said, yes, I direct. I said, if you're referring to the guy without the E, the Scottish guy, I said, no, it's not me. And along the same line, I remember once we had both stayed at the same hotel, or perhaps we even still do, I don't know. And one time I got a phone call. Hey, Bill, if you're out there, I got a phone call once from someone. You know, it was like a personal thing. And I was like, well, no, I think you got the wrong guy, you know.
How personal was it? Okay. Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about acting.
Thank you very much.
William Forsythe, he's currently shooting The Brotherhood with Brian Bosworth. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have from the Middle East?
Hi, Terry. The Middle East, of course, continues to be in considerable tension this evening. Turkey has agreed to cut off oil from Iraq to stop loading tankers there with Iraqi oil. A discussion of the sudden resolve of the United Nations Security Council voting 13-0 to sanction Iraq because of the invasion of Kuwait. NPR's John Madison explains the deal made yesterday in South Africa, the African National Congress renouncing the use of violence in exchange for various political concessions. Also tonight, we'll meet a young singer-songwriter, originally from Georgia, a fat white boy, in his words. His name is Brooks Williams.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The National Endowment for the Arts is embroiled in a series of controversies, some of which were addressed when the agency's main advisory panel met this weekend in Washington, D.C. Performance artists Karen Finley and Holly Hughes are back in the eye of the storm. The sexual and political content of their work make it controversial. Some have called it indecent. Earlier this summer, their NEA grants were vetoed by Chairman John Frohnmayer in spite of the favorable recommendation of peer review panels. Two new applications by the artists were on the agenda this weekend. Again, their proposals had been passed by peer panels. But this time, Frohnmayer urged the Advisory Council to send the applications to a new set of peer panels, and they agreed. I asked Stefan Salisbury what the reasons were. Salisbury is covering the NEA for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
There was a question of conflict of interest with those two grants and with three others. Hughes and Finley have two collaborators who sat on the panels that recommended the grants. That's not unusual with the endowment, and the endowment has ethical guidelines to cover such situations, which were followed in this case. Essentially, the council changed the rules in midstream. They said, yes, you followed the rules, but that's not good enough in these troubled times. And so they sent the grants back to a newly constituted panel that won't be open to charges of conflict. This, I might say, really enraged artists in Washington who were observing the meeting, and it disheartened endowment staffers. The core of the endowment, what makes the endowment work, they say, has been the integrity of the peer panel process. And what this decision has done is cast a shadow over that process.
When does the Congress vote on the reauthorization of the NEA?
Well, that's a $64 question. The Speaker of the House has said that he would bring the endowment matter to the floor of the House in September, or he says possibly October. There's a growing feeling among endowment supporters on Capitol Hill that perhaps reauthorizing the entire agency might not be the best course during an election year, and that perhaps just simply carrying the endowment over into next year using, say, the appropriations legislation as a vehicle might be the best course, avoiding a very divisive floor fight.
Would you say that within the NEA there's division now over how to proceed?
Within the NEA itself, I think there are a number of very dispirited people. I think that they see their principal constituency as the arts community. This is, after all, the community that they are funding. And they see a number of the decisions that have been made in recent months as undercutting the endowment's relationship with that community. I think it's important to realize that that Frohnmayer's decisions and his conduct of the meeting really were like the head of any embattled federal agency. But the fact of the matter is that the NEA is not like any federal agency. It's not we're not talking about $5,000 for toilet seats here or $500 lug nuts. We're talking about art. And therefore, his actions and his decisions aren't really aimed at cutting waste or mismanagement. They raise questions about aesthetics and censorship and fairness. And these are questions that are right at the heart of American culture. And I think that's why this debate has become so rancorous. I think that's an extremely important point.
Stephen Salisbury is a cultural affairs reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shirock. I'm Terry Gross. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we meet Andrew Saris, a film critic who encouraged Americans to take our own westerns, crime movies, and thrillers as seriously as the French did. Also, actor Giancarlo Esposito on acting in the Spike Lee movies School Days, Do the Right Thing, and Mo' Better Blues. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
On her way back to the sofa, she saw that the electric clock read close to 10. She wondered what to do with St. George if Silas called. But they watched news and weather and Johnny Carson in the late movie, and Silas didn't.
Jane Curtin reads Gail Godwin on the next program of Selected Shorts.
Tune in tomorrow at 3 o'clock for Selected Shorts here on 91 FM, WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.